Hi everyone, this is Jordan.
And I'm Maya.
Today we've got a special guest. Maya, do you want to introduce them?
Sure. So we are super excited to have Dr. Anne Burgess on for our interview. Dr. Burgess, would you like to give a little bit of your background?
Sure. My name is Anne Burgess. I have been in nursing. I came into the field of psychiatric nursing as an undergraduate and graduate, and then got my doctorate at Boston University, my undergraduate also at Boston University, and my master's at University of Maryland, and have worked with psychiatric patients. It's actually where I started learning and getting some of my interest, if you will, in crime victims. But that was down in Maryland. I lived down there after graduation and then moved back to Boston and started teaching at Boston College. And that's where I ran into Linda Lytle-Holmstrom, and we started doing a major study on rape victims. That's really what got me into understanding crime victims and trauma. And from there, I was asked to start lecturing down at the FBI Academy. That's what got me more interested, if you will, in the offender. So I spent a fair amount of time down there, helped them with a serial killer study and profiling, and then came back to Boston, of course. And that brought me, by that time, I was doing a fair number of cases on my own, and that would bring us up to the Menendez case, which I know we're here to talk about today. Did you want to know how I got involved in it?
Yeah, sure.
Because that was kind of interesting. I didn't know a thing about the case. You know, I live in Boston. I live on the East Coast. This was going on the West Coast. I don't get any of the West Coast magazines. So John Conte, who is, he at the time was at University of Chicago, and is a very well-known traumatologist also. And he had been called by Jill to do Lyle, to be the expert on Lyle. And I think that Leslie Abramson had already talked with someone about the theory and was looking for kind of a theory, I guess, is what you'd say a defense lawyer was trying to do, and was not happy with that person. And so had asked Jill, and Jill had asked John Conte who he would suggest. So they would get John to call me. That's what's kind of done in the field. You get somebody who knows the person to call and say, are you interested? And if they say no, then you say, hey, forget it, get somebody else, which is a nice way of doing it. But anyway, so John calls me and he says, have you heard about these two brothers that shotgunned their parents? And I said, no, I hadn't. And I said, well, what about it? And rather than going into it, he said, well, the story is in a People magazine. And he said, it's a purple cover. Go out and buy it and read about it. So that was my initiation into the case. It was People magazine. I guess they had just done a story on it. So when I said, sure, I'd think about it, if he was going to be involved, I really respect John. And I thought, well, if he's going to do it, I might as well do it too. So very naively got into this whole thing, and Leslie called, and that the rest is history. She did invite me out, and she's fascinating. It was quite a weekend, and actually did get me in to see them, actually see Eric. I don't think I didn't see Lyle that time. So I spent a lot of time with him that weekend just to get some basics done. And then I came back home and then went back out again. As more information came out, I think the confession had finally been ruled on that it was going to come in. So they needed me to see that and some other things. So that's really how I got into it.
What year was that you first got involved?
Well, it would have been about a year before the trial. And what was the trial in 92?
93.
So 90, 91, somewhere around there.
I don't know if there's anything you want to add about what you've done since then. I reached out to you because I saw that you are still teaching at Boston College, which is in the same city that I go to school.
Yeah, that was actually very interesting. I had not if you will, thought that much about the case until your email came. And I was really intrigued because you would talk to me a little bit about what I wasn't aware of, that there was some revived interest, if you will, in the case. And so I was delighted that you could come to one of my classes. And I think I did do the case there. But since then, have become even more interested in it and trying to, that I'll talk about today, and have actually been in touch with Leslie Abramson and with John Conte, both two very instrumental parties, if you will, in the case. And there's a very interesting case. It took up three solid weeks, not all at the same time, but I had to go and testify three separate times all the way out to California that I hadn't planned on, if you will. I thought, well, I'll just go out and testify once. No, that wasn't going to be the situation. They kept coming into other things that they wanted me to testify to. And as I said, we can talk a little bit about that. I think one of the more interesting things is that you had two juries. I never had that experience of having two juries. And sometimes you talk just to one jury and then sometimes to both. I never talked only to Lyle because I was not there as a examiner or expert for Lyle, but was for Eric. So just those dynamics are even very interesting of how the two juries were, if you will, on viewing them and speaking to them and trying to get across something of interest to them with the case.
That's awesome. Very interesting to hear.
Yeah.
When you were initially asked to do an evaluation of Eric, were you also asked to do a evaluation of the crime scene too? Or was that something that they had asked you to do later on?
No, you're right. It was later that we got into that. They wanted me for what we would call a trauma expert to talk more about child abuse, et cetera. And then as they learned a little bit more about what my experience had been, I know Jill, who was the lead defense attorney for Lyle, felt that that was important information for her jury to hear. So as they kind of went, as we talked about what I was going to testify to or what I could testify to, is when they would make a determination of whether I could come in for both of the juries or whether just one of the jury. So all of that was very, very new to me. In fact, I've never had to do two juries before, but that's obviously because you have to have two defendants. And that was the case. And I think the other interesting thing was that they had decided, the brothers had decided, that they were going to stick together. They were not going to separate and do separate trials. And so even though one of the attorneys wasn't happy with that, would have preferred to just do her case separately and felt that she had a much better chance just doing it separately. But the brothers won out. They just determined they wanted to both, they had both been involved in the incident and wanted to both follow it through.
Interesting that you brought up that the crime scene analysis wasn't something that you were initially asked to do, because that was like the part of your testimony that was the most influential to me, because it was like very much reframed the whole crime.
Yeah, well, and I was surprised that they didn't have someone there to do that. Of course, they had detectives and investigators ahead for the prosecution, of course, testified, but I was used to always wanting the crime scene and being able to see it. Now, I wasn't able to see it, obviously, because it was later. The house had been taken apart, if you will, was not available to see. But I had all the crime scene photos, which is often all that you have. So I did have that as a matter to be able to go over and to see where everybody was sitting, how it came in. And then I had I had Eric certainly tell me of what it was like for him. And I had Eric do some drawings. I often do that with whomever I'm evaluating, because it gives it something concrete to then talk about. Well, why did you put this here? Or what does this piece over here mean? And so it moves it out of the realm of you just talk to me and tell me, to kind of making the person you're hoping to kind of go back and relive it and give you more details. So I really have that also. And he, Eric was very, very detailed, if you will, when he did the drawings. He made about close to 20 drawings for me of that whole week. That whole week was very, very important. And so he wasn't, he didn't do as much on the crime scene in terms of the drawing, but I had, as I said, I had the crime scene photos, and that was helpful.
What was the biggest clue to you from the crime scene that indicated a lack of planning?
Well, you have to be a little careful in talking about planning. We were at that time using the terms of organized, disorganized as going to a crime scene. And what could you tell from that? But it was the because they had picked up the casings, you know, from the shotgun shells. So prosecution always pointed to that to say, well, it wasn't that important, and they had planned it and they knew to do that. No, yeah. That didn't mean that at all. But anytime you think you have something, you know, the other side's going to come out and try to hit you back down with it. But I think that what, to answer your question, is that the crime scene showed it was just so out of the blue of an experience. It wasn't that they never had it planned in that respect. I'm not sure even knew what the parents were doing at that particular time. It just was because it was like, what, I think around 8 o'clock at night. And they did it at a time when people could have heard it, and people did hear it. People did hear the shots and did nothing. It's almost like that Kitty Genovese case where you remember the young woman that neighbors heard her screaming and so forth and did nothing, the bystander response, you know. So I thought that they could have, that was the most profound thing, is why didn't someone say, you know, who's firing shots over there? Because the doors are open. Don't forget, it was a hot August day. The doors were open. There was no way that they could have muffled, if you will. I mean, it wasn't that they, if they had planned it, they could have put a silencer on the gun, right? They could have gotten different guns, if you will. So it wasn't even that was what was planned for it. They had never even shot a gun prior to that. So all of those things, I think, were very important in trying to put together. Of course, the main thing that I found was when the police did arrive, and the odor of shotgun, the odor from a shotgun or from a gun, you know, the bullet odor, if it had just happened, it should have been there, and it wasn't, right? And they could have done the hands, could have done a lab test on the hands and could have stopped it right there, could have stopped the whole investigation right there. It was really I guess they had to say, well, they didn't get many of these kinds of shootings in the area, but that's no excuse for they're not doing a thorough investigation. So it was really quite, and nobody thought, of course, that it was the brothers that had done it. That was more of trying to say it was the mafia or something. So it was quite a scene, that's for sure.
So one of the things that you talked about in your testimony was how the like randomness of the shots indicated that it was like driven by fear.
Yeah, fear. Well, I definitely felt it was by fear because it was such, there's so much of it. The multiple shots into Jose, I think he had 6 and Kitty had 10. And that's really far, far more than were needed to kill someone. So the fear of that, I always make the analogy that hopefully people can understand, you know, when you see this little tiny bee or this spider crawling around, which is really tiny, and how many times people stamp and swat at it. And it's one swat would probably kill it, but no, they put 20 swats at it. So it's that fear, and that's the same kind of a kind of stress response that you get when you are in fear of your life. And that's what I felt had certainly played a major role in the emotional, if you will, emotional part of the shooting.
I was wondering if you had like since then, or I guess before, to ever like evaluated other shootings that were driven by fear, and like how do they compare to this crime scene?
There was a case I had done before, up in Saratoga Springs, New York, where it was a young woman. She was only 17 too, who shotgunned her father because she was in fear. And she shotgunned him. She didn't even remember, but there were 11 shots used. That's a lot. And it was, again, there was incest that hadn't been disclosed. And it all came out. She was convicted, but then because she was a juvenile in New York State at that time, they allowed a special hearing for her to get into treatment rather than to have to go to prison. Yeah. As I said, the Cruikshank case was my prior experience with a overabundance of bullets being shot from a shotgun, interestingly enough, at the father. Only one which really killed him, but the others were, so it just meant random.
Overkill.
Yeah, overkill. Although there are certainly times that are overkill. Anytime you see a known person, don't forget it's a known person, not a stranger, that the victim is, can indicate the emotional response. So you would see that in some domestic violence cases where there's, and sometimes that's even done when the victim is sleeping or not even conscious, you know, as a way, because they are so fearful of the victim that's when they have to commit the crime. So crime scene would be important. A crime scene is always important because you want to know where the bullets are and where they had been aimed. If you know, in the Menendez case, the brothers came in from a side door. It was one of those doors that opened up into a patio or something, and they would come in. And Eric was first. Lyle made him go first, probably because he thought maybe he wouldn't if he didn't.
Yeah, in terms of fear, like a lot has changed over the past 25 years in terms of the understanding of the effects of child abuse on the brain and child psychology in general. Could you talk about some of the developments in the field?
Yeah, and it was interesting back, and don't forget, back in that time period of the late 1990s, it was also the decade of the brain, and NIH was putting a lot of money into studying the brain and how that affected us. And so I had found some of the early research, and the ellipsis snail was one of the first. And that's a very interesting type of research that was going on, because when you touch a snail, what does it do? It goes back in its little shell. So it has what you call a fear response. And they were starting to do some really interesting studies on fear response and how many times could you tap one of these snails. They're useful for research because they have very large neurons in the brain. And so they could study that. And I can remember I think one of my testimonies did include that. And I can remember being chided for that, you know, made fun of. Oh, she talked about snails, kind of thing like that.
Ms. Bozanich.
I don't really appreciate the research that goes on. But they were studying the brain, don't forget, and trying to make some comparison to the brain, and really did learn it was the limbic system and the hippocampus area in the limbic system that governs all of our memory and our emotion. And that is, if you activate that, obviously you can certainly stimulate that fear response. So I was trying to bring the best of the research, and some of people that I won't name really thought they were being pretty smart and making fun of my testimony. You probably have heard other stories too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's on video. We can name names, right? Some of the prosecutors dismissed your testimony as psychobabble.
Dr. Burgess, do you know what psychobabble is?
Overall.
Do you know what psychobabble is?
No, I don't. I have nothing further.
All right, any redirect?
Yes.
Do you know what a prosecutor trying to argue their case to a witness is, Dr. Burgess? I
think that's right. All right, sustain.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. I mean, right. They asked me what a psycho bottle, and I really was not. That was that Pam. That question came out of the blue, and they will do anything to try to diminish you. You know, so I was. I usually just put my bulletproof vest on and go in and testify because they're going to shoot at you. So, I mean, that's their job. I think that even they had another on the second trial. They had another expert that came in to put down the psychobabble. I think he was the only one that testified. I guess he was the only one they let testify.
Yeah,
for the prosecution. Yeah. Yes. Deeds.
His testimony was interesting, to say the least.
Yeah, I didn't follow it. I know that he did. He didn't. He said, "Well, Eric or whoever he was talking about didn't have what PTSD." Well, nobody really said he had PTSD, if you will, but he took it upon himself to display that he would never give that diagnosis. He would give general anxiety disorder, which for PTSD is anxiety disorder at that particular time in the DSM. Did you have a particular question, Jordan, on his testimony?
I just found his testimony to be a bit, I don't want to say pointless, but it sort of felt like he was brought in to sort of put a dampener on the defense experts' evaluations of Eric.
Sure,
but
right.
His evaluation didn't really do that, in my opinion. Like, it didn't really change my opinion.
Right.
So I was wondering, like, if you had, like, worked with him previously or if you knew of him.
Oh, yes, I certainly know of him, and I had worked with him. We had published in the area of autoerotic fatalities. We had done a book together and with one of the FBI agents, Roy Hazelwood. So, yes, I know him. What do you want to know? No.
Is he a nice guy?
We'll save that for later. There was one other expert. I don't know if you talked about him, Stuart Hart.
Yeah.
Okay, because he is out of Indiana, and he did the testimony on, in general, on the psychological and the emotional trauma. I remember he would do that. I don't know if you had a chance to talk to him, but...
That would be really interesting, actually, because he spoke a lot about the psychological maltreatment.
Right. Oh, there was lots of that. There's no question there. But I think he kept in touch with Eric since then.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't he on a documentary?
He could have been.
Stuart Hart was on a recent, when I say recent, I mean like 2017. He did an interview with Chris Cuomo. And I know took part in that as well.
Okay.
And Stuart Hart was there.
Okay. Right. We saw a little bit of him. Don't forget, we were at different times so that we wouldn't really run into each other, if you will. Because I know some of the things that I testified to, John hadn't heard of. So we did not talk. The experts did not talk within themselves about the testimony. You're not supposed to, I guess you could after that you testified, but. Never did till a couple of weeks ago.
So did you get back in contact for your book?
Right. That's what I wanted to get back in touch with them for my book. Yeah. Right. That's going to be a chapter.
Nice.
It'll be a chapter. Yeah. It's going to be a chapter with some of the other cases I've done, especially around the, do you believe, you know, is it, do you believe the testimony of the young, the plaintiff? If you will. I do the Duke LaCrosse case where they had the young woman that said that she was raped by the, and then I do the Kobe Bryant case where that was a rape charge, and Bill Cosby, that was a rape charge. So all of those, and of course this case.
Well, here's a little preview promo, I guess, when it comes out.
Yeah. Well, my other book comes out. My first book comes out in December. That's on the Killer by Design. That's on the profiling, my work with the FBI profilers. on how they would go to a crime scene and profile. So you'll have to have me back talk about that.
What were my preliminary opinions? What did I think after I saw them or saw Eric? And then also I saw Lyle. And my whole feeling, and I confirmed this with John a couple of weeks ago when I talked to him, is I said, something has to be really, really wrong for these two brothers to kill their parents. That is so unusual that something is deep, dark secret kind of thing has to be operating. And it has to be the way that they were treated. And of course, as I got more and more information, it was incredible what they were going through. There's much psychological abuse and emotional abuse, as well as the sexual abuse. And they said, you know, they talked about it, and people always said, well, why do you believe them? Well, my question is, well, why shouldn't I? You know, there's no one else there. And that makes sense. It's the whole theory that the prosecution had, that it was for money, was they had all the money they needed. In fact, you know, they were in college. Well, the big thing that was going to come up, of course, was Eric going to college. And they thought that they were going to be free of the father because Lyle was going to be coming back to Princeton, even though he had been suspended. The father had gotten him back in, or he was allowed back in. So he was going to be home free back here on the East Coast. And it was just a matter of Eric was looking forward to going to UC. Until the father dropped the bomb on him that no, he wasn't going to be allowed to live at college, which to me was another very strange thing. Wouldn't you want your son to live away and have the experience of, you know, living in a dorm and all of that? No, the father said, I'll get you a moped, one of those little scooter bikes. Wow. And you can take your scooter bike to school every day and be home at night. And for him, of course, and it made no sense. And that really scared him. If you want to talk about being scared and fearful about what was going to happen, he knew everything was going to continue. So my opinion was the sexual abuse of the whole scenario of it was very, very key to the reaction they had, and that they thought if this secret ever came out, this would ruin father's career, et cetera, et cetera. So
when you first evaluated Eric, had he already disclosed the sexual abuse?
Oh, he had disclosed it to the cousins knew about it. I know that John had found that out, but it was not to be discussed. I mean, from that member, it never is something that is freely discussed in the family. His grandmother was very devoted. There was an aunt who I think she was not so convinced that there had been sexual abuse. And but I don't think she ever said that. I think she said it to a journalist or something. Is hard. You know, if she was the sister of Jose, and incest is a hard concept for people to grasp, I think. And so I can see where, and it's certainly something that the brothers didn't talk about to anyone. Was it discussed to any authority people?
I know that he had initially his like psychiatrist in jail. And then they hadn't been revealing the abuse to him. And then finally Eric revealed it. So when he first started talking to you, was he, I don't want to say like open about it.
Yes, he was open about it in terms of, because you're absolutely correct. The way it does come out is to the psychiatrist. And that's something that Leslie had made sure that he would get some treatment, because he was starting to really kind of fall apart. And so puts him into treatment. So yes. Was he open about it? Once he was able to talk about it, yes. I mean, he told me essentially what the testimony was, and I think it was very consistent.
So we had a question from one of our viewers, actually, which was, what was the most compelling sign or like psychological sign of abuse that you saw in Eric during your evaluation?
It was I think the way he described what happened and his drawings were very powerful. So it wasn't just his verbalizing, but how he interpreted the mother's rejection, if you will, of both he and his brother, even though she should have welcomed the to go with them and get away. They were planning, he wanted to go back to the East Coast. But the compelling symptom just had to be the way he talked about it and the way he drew it and all of the details that he had. So it wasn't just his talking. I guess that's what really impressed me the most is these drawings that he did. And he had all the dialogue in there. And he would do it, he would emphasize it in some ways and not in other ways. He acted out, don't forget. I think that's always a trauma sign that they tried to make a lot of, robbed some minor things. Again, these are boys that had whatever they wanted. So the idea of stealing or robbing is so really foreign to them. And that was the same on the Rolex watches. I always thought that was interesting. They said, oh, they went out and bought these Rolex watches. Well, they didn't keep them for themselves. They gave them away. So they weren't even taking the things, you know, for themselves. So I think I would add that. And of course, Lyle having trouble in relationships and in school, and he should have been able to manage school and wasn't. So those would all be signs, I think, that said to me that something was really wrong. The only thing he really excelled at that I don't think he had trouble with was his tennis. I'm just speaking about Eric. He was really a very good, as I understand it, tennis player. And so that was, and that's something that he could do alone, that he could excel at. So I think that gave him real confidence in himself. And it wasn't, he didn't have to think about what was going on at home.
Yeah, I think Eric has spoken about this in his testimony, but I mean, we speak about like dissociation and sort of blocking out trauma. Do you think the tennis in this case was, I think people see it as an abusive tennis schedule, but to an extent, do you think it helped in a way?
Oh, I think it helped definitely because it allowed him not to have to think what was going on. And he could just focus. He could just focus in on that. He had to just hit that little ball, right? and that he didn't have to worry about anyone saying anything or doing anything. He could just focus in on that and keep winning and keep achieving. So I would say yes to your question. It was really, really important. I don't know Lyle. Lyle certainly was a tennis player too. I don't know if he performed at the same skill level. Do you? I don't know.
Yeah, it was a similar skill level, right, Maya?
Yeah.
Was he?
Yeah.
Speaking of Lyle, did Eric talk a lot about Lyle when you were evaluating him? And
yes,
how did
yes.
you?
It was very clear. Yeah, that was interesting. It was very clear that it was kind of like conjoined twins, if you will, as far as he was concerned. Lyle, on the other hand, I think always saw him as the little brother and he was the big brother, whereas Eric really saw him as his support. And he talked a lot. It was hard to get him off the subject when you're just trying to. But of course, they did everything together and this whole thing was done together. So it's not surprising that they would talk. I think Lyle was the only one that got angry at. I don't think Eric would get angry at Lyle. I don't think he would dare because he was he was his main support. Once the mother made her position known.
Going off of, since we're talking about the mother, how do you sort of view her role in this whole family system? And is it typical of like incest mothers?
Oh, I think it is. She was supportive of the father, even though he was having multiple affairs. I think if you read any of the comments, if you will, from his associates, he had evidently had a mistress for years that he was also had multiple women on the side. you have to assume she knew about that or knew something about that. And yet she was into the alcohol and the drugs and as a way to kind of cope, but was not going to leave him, And I think they found out that she did know that something was going on with the boy, with the brothers, and did nothing about it. That's one of the things that I think made, certainly Noah made Eric very angry, And because people say, well, oh, she was so innocent in all of this. No, she wasn't. She really wasn't. She couldn't have been. The dynamics of the family, if she was so innocent of it, she would have, and cared about her son, she would have left with them to set up some other kind of a situation. Yeah, and she was not, I know she was at home, but she never, the inside of the house, as I understand it, was not like the outside of the house. That it was, you would think it would be very well appointed, lots of good furniture, things like that, immaculate. They had these animals, these little animals that ran around.
The ferrets.
Yeah, right. That's it, ferrets, yeah. And I guess they were just let loose in the house. Well, you can imagine what that was like. So as I said, things, if you went into the house, it's going to be very different. Just like if you got into the head of the boys and their feelings and so forth, they're very different from the outer appearance of her, just this one big happy family.
Was Kitty, could she be described as a narcissist?
Well, yeah, she was into her own thing from that standpoint, sure, and concerned about herself and supposedly the relationship with Jose.
Like her obsessiveness with Jose.
Yeah. She certainly didn't. And you have to look at why he's selected her. Remember, she was a beauty queen, so he liked to have something that he could show, if you will, off and around, so that made sense for him to, because he had come in from Cuba. He was evidently very ruthless. That he, you heard some of the colleagues say that he could humiliate people in front of others, which you is not a very good thing to do as a boss, right? And that he could fire people without any second thought. So people, even though they might have said his strengths where he's hardworking and he does well, et cetera, you always could find people saying the opposite kind of a thing. So he was, on the outside, he was one way, we could say, and yet on the inside, certainly quite another. They all had two sides. There was two sides to this family.
Yeah, it makes me think a lot about how important, especially to this case, the like the public image of the family was, and yes, how it's very different behind closed doors.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely, yes. And heaven knows what was going on between Kitty and Jose. We would never know that. But you never heard of them having a lot of, and doing a lot of entertaining or socializing, etc. The one thing I think they did say about Kitty is she did go to all of the boys' tennis tournaments or whatever games they were in. But I remember one of the stories that Eric told me, and it really set, because as a teacher, that if they had a grade that the parent, the father especially, didn't like, maybe a B, I don't know what it is, they went in and intimidated the teachers. And that to me, I thought, if I ever had a parent come in and say they didn't like what little Johnny got, for a grade, I'd but they went along evidently and changed the grades. So that's really going above and beyond. I don't think many parents do that.
Something else in relation to Kitty that I thought was interesting is that I think it was one of her therapists when the family had moved to California, Dr. Cox, he had mentioned that she only viewed her son's worth as trophies for the family. And I that stuck out to me a lot because...
Yep, that's good. That's a good, absolutely. Like, trophy for the family.
Yeah, I just don't understand how a mother could have that line of thinking in regard to her children.
Well, now you know. I mean, look what happened. Those dynamics. I mean, can you imagine living in that kind of a setting? Yeah. a very dysfunctional family. I think that's to put it mildly, obviously.
I guess on the other side, for the father, do you think that he could be like diagnosed clinically as a psychopath with ASPD?
Yeah, I don't know. He certainly had characteristics that were that. I don't know whether, well, you should have asked Dr. Dietz, right? to diagnose him. You should have asked him. He certainly was on his own mission. I guess we could say that, right? I think, didn't he want to be president of Cuba or something someday? I remember that. I remember the Eric talking a lot, and I think Lyle did too, about what their father had as goals for them. And although he didn't always publicize his Cuban heritage, as I understand it. So there was a mixed message there, if you will. I don't know whether he would be called antisocial. Well, certainly the way he handled his associates and work, that sounds it. But the way he treated his sons was certainly pathological. You can certainly say that, for them to then do what they did. And they're just intense, the impossible goals that or standards that he had for them. You know, the rigid schedule that they had. They had to, get up at 5 a.m. and get on the tennis court at 6 and do something at 7 and then back to school. And there was no variation there. So to give him a psychopathic diagnosis, did he do any illegal kinds of things? Was his work? Was there any fraudulent behavior there? I don't think we heard any of that. We certainly knew that he had his extramarital affairs. That's not enough to say that he's psychopathic, but he certainly was brutal and abusive to his family.
Also, his sadistic nature, especially with the sexual abuse, that was pretty disturbing to me.
Right. That it could have been what we call muted sadism. Not so overt sadism, but that's a good concern, muted sadism of how he, the things that he did, certainly, to the boy, to Eric and to Lyle, if you will. I do know that the family did know that Jose would take Eric or Lyle. Lyle, I think, because he was the favored one. Lyle clearly was the favored son. And would take him, like when the family would be over, the other family members would be over, and he could just go and do anything, be alone with Lyle, and they wouldn't know necessarily what was going on. And they all had to wait. They couldn't eat until Jose came back. I mean, he very much was the patriarch, and you had to do everything that he wanted you to do. So there was that kind of, what's he doing, with all of that focused in on Lyle. And because Lyle was the favored one, he was given certain, that he and father would have said things to him that he would never say to Eric. So Lyle was the stronger, if you will, psychologically in a way of the two. If that makes sense. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Well, he was definitely the abused. Well, I don't even know if he was abused less. Sexually abused less, but the psychological abuse.
What about Lyle's, the brainwashing sessions?
Yeah, I don't know. Did you talk to Lyle ever?
I didn't talk to Lyle about the brainwashing sessions. Jordan, were you thinking of when they were with Ozeal? Or Eric, when he's being brainwashed. I know Eric would be easily brainwashed because that was his nature, if you will, with the father.
Yeah, I was referring to when people testified to knowing that Lyle would have these head-to-head, knee-to-knee lecture sessions with his father. And I think people think that had a big impact on him.
Oh, it did. Yeah, that's what the... I know that's what the aunt said, the cousin said, that Jose would take him downstairs, take him to a separate place and do that. And that's rather odd, don't you think?
Definitely.
Yeah,
definitely.
Yeah, so I mean, that's certainly abusive in its own way, whatever they talked about, whatever he was getting brainwashed on, that's for sure. So,
do you know what, thinking, there was something I wanted to ask, is what would you say to people who are typically pro-prosecution, and especially in this case, a lot with the older generation, Eric and Lyle get painted as sociopaths? What would you say to that?
That's interesting, because I think didn't Kitty at one point say something about the sons being sociopaths?
Yes. You had privy to Dr. Sommerfeld's notes, yeah. Right? Her therapist.
I didn't see them as sociopaths. What
infractions did they have? Well, they certainly had that robbery, but I really saw the robbery more as the post-trauma, the trauma response. What else did they do? Did they cheat and lie and all those things that you would expect of a sociopath? I didn't see them that way, obviously. But I think people that are pro-prosecution absolutely would. Sure. And dismiss them as that.
Yeah.
They're just sociopaths, right? They're just lying about it. Well, you don't, you might lie about some things, but you don't kill your parents. You know, something seriously is wrong. And my other thought, I thought, you know, these young brothers were on the stand for days, and the prosecution had ample room and time to get from them. It isn't like they refused to testify, like happens in a lot of cases. I know that Dominic Dunn, who was very anti these brothers, had a moment when he thought maybe he was wrong, and had not realized that this really could have gone on. And he said it was during their testimony that he was convinced. So that's when I thought that was really important that they were on the stand as long as they were. That's a long time to be on the stand. 8 days or whatever it was. Were they on the stand that much in the second trial? See, I didn't follow the second trial.
Lyle didn't testify, but yeah, Eric was on the stand for a similar amount of days in the second trial.
Oh, so he testified, but not Lyle. Okay.
I don't think we wrote this question down, but I am curious. I know when I went to your class, you mentioned that Dominic Dunn had approached you and like wanted to ask you questions, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah, he got me one day. I want to talk to you when this is over. And I said, oh, absolutely, because I know I wouldn't be there right when it's over. But I would have talked. I would have talked to him. But he then got on to the. I think the OJ case came up, and so he went right from that, from the Menendez case over to the OJ case.
I was wondering if, like, as a witness, the media attention was like you could tell that it was a case that had a lot of media attention, or how that affected your involvement.
Oh, I think it affected it in a great way. I mean, at times it was almost like a soap opera, you know, when the Julian Smith got on and talked about that, and that she had been the mistress of Ozil. And I mean, it just went from one thing to another. You could wonder how much more is going to come out. And she was intimidated, and she testified for the defense, wasn't that? And Ozil testified for the prosecution. Talk about a turn of events, you know, that case just never, it was some case. And the media just, of course, this was kind of, you can imagine in that, you know, what, 20, 30 years ago, how that all came down. It was hard to be in the courtroom. It was packed. So it raised one's own anxiety about having to testify. And knowing that the cameras were on you, it was bad enough. So there's a lot of stress, yeah. They had quite a following, I will say that. They had a lot of following back then. I got called a lot. Everyone wanted to know what I thought, you know, that kind of thing. I said, well, I testified, that's what I thought. Oh. I think that the judge engineered the verdict in that second trial. It sounds like he was able to keep people out from testifying, that so then the jury didn't get much of the information that the first jury had. Yeah, because John didn't testify. I didn't testify. Did Stuart testify? Maybe not.
I don't think so, no.
I think it was just one expert.
See, I've seen that happen. I did a case where it was horrible because everything I had came from my interview. And they said that's all secondhand. Hmm. That they have to testify. That. So I thought, well, what's the sense of being an expert if you can't testify to what the person said? But that's what he was using. That's what the judge was using. So I'm surprised that Lyle didn't testify. Yeah, I think the second trial, also the confession tape, that must have played a big role too.
Yeah, right? Some of the jurors have said that.
Yeah.
Did you want to ask much about the 12-11 tape, Lyle?
Yeah, I was going to say, if we had a couple of questions about the confession tape. What was your initial reaction to hearing it?
Well, my reaction was, you always take into consideration what's going on, and that was Ozeal. Don't forget, I understand there were four tapes. Two of them were of his notes, and therapy notes afterwards. And then one is he pressured them for that December 12th tape. Oh, just tell it on tape and then everything will be okay. Well, I don't know why they went into that. So anyway, that was the context that it came in. And what they said to me is how they were pressured into saying certain things. And I know that can happen. I know that you can get false confessions easily. I've done a couple of cases of false confessions. And so that wasn't a surprise to me that he would say that, and that they could have said anything they wanted to say. And he would direct what he said. But I think all they said on the tape, if I remember, was that they had to get away from the father. He was just so impossible. And they did not say anything about the sexual abuse or the abuse, which made sense because I don't think that was something they were talking about at that particular time. Yeah, so that he wasn't going to disclose that at that particular time. So to me, we had to explain it, the confession tape. And I would say that was I forget what I did say, but that was something that Ozeal was pushing for so it would clear him, more to clear him. And then he tried to say that he was threatened by them. And that was one of the reasons that they allowed the tape, because usually you don't bring in any patient therapist commentary. But they said because he had threatened them, and I never did hear what the threat was. I don't think that was on the tape, was it?
No.
No. So that was, I just think they wanted to bring the tapes in. We just went over it. Eric just told me what it said, and we knew it was going to come in. So you're prepared for it. You certainly don't want to go in and have them surprise you with a question.
Yeah. I think that the reason why the people find the tape so interesting is because of all the hints and the metaphors. And I know that Eric repeatedly says on the tape that he had no choice. But I think what impacted the second trial jury a lot was Lyle's voice on the tape, where Lyle is talking about letting Eric sleep on it for a couple of days.
Oh, right. Take a couple of days to sleep on it. That's right. That's right. Maybe that's why they didn't have Lyle testify. They just used the confession tape, right?
Yeah, the confession tape was played at the start, right, Maya?
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's no background information. Eric hadn't testified yet. So
and
they just heard that. Yeah.
Ozeal didn't testify in the second trial either. They didn't get to hear about how shady he was.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Eric saying he didn't have a choice is he didn't have a choice in how this was all going to stop. And he never felt he had a choice with the father. And I don't think he felt he had a choice with Ozeal. Don't forget, he would be reacting to any male authority as he did to the father. And so he was always feeling very inadequate to anything. That's just the way he was, he developed.
One of the things that you had talked about in your testimony was that Lyle was using mother as a metaphor for Brother, where he was saying that he killed his father because of what he was doing to his mother, but it was a metaphor for what he was doing to his brother. So I guess I was, when I heard that, I was a little confused about like why a patient would do that or how that would happen in a patient's mind that they would make a metaphor like that.
Well, I think that it now still goes back to the dynamics of this family and that they get the roles so kind of confused and would try to explain things in this way. The mother was really relegated to a pretty minor position once that came out that, don't forget, she did such humiliating things to Lyle. Remember with the toupee that he had, and that must have been, luckily nobody else was there, but it was embarrassing and humiliating. And then, so she had her own way of dealing with Lyle. She probably reacted to Lyle differently than she did to Eric, because the father would show the preference to the eldest son, and she may have, in her own way, treated Eric very differently. Of course, we won't know, but you had to listen to the brothers tell different stories about their growing up. So to get back to the metaphor of mother for brother is where I saw some blurring of roles, what we call blurring, and who's doing what was the brother, the mother, so to speak, and reverse those roles too. And did he react to them in a different way? If they had, for whatever the, that's what I think it was important in the relationship. It was so dysfunctional that's why I testified to the way I did. That would be my explanation.
That actually makes a lot of sense. I had not thought about it that way. Mm-hmm. That sort of just the way that the family was set up, there's no, like everyone had kind of a different role and it was just a giant mess. And so that's sort of where the lines were blurred with that.
Yeah. Well, I think they had very blurred boundaries. You always do when you have sexual abuse. So that was blurred.
This was a question from a viewer as well. How did people outside of the case treat you after you were a witness in this case?
It was interesting. Males, and especially any of the law enforcement, of course, were very pro-prosecution. So they didn't like the idea that I was testifying for the defense, first of all. And so that I did get some, I know I didn't get a lot to my face, but I know that behind the scenes, there would have been a lot of talk. And I hadn't at that time done a lot of defense work. So that was kind of my first, but I do know that someone said that watched the testimony said they were anxious to see what I was going to say. And they were surprised, pleasantly surprised, because I never said, oh, that actually happened, because I couldn't say that. That's up to the jury to come up with were they or weren't they, but that to just give enough information that the brothers had told me for the jury to come to their own conclusions. And if I said, I would say that this is what they told me, you know, say what Eric said. It was really Eric that I was focused on for the most part. I think I only did the double jury when we did crime scene, or we did, I don't think we did confession tape. I think it was just Eric.
Do you think that because of what the societal norms and standards were at the time and the views about sexual abuse in general, do you think that played a lot into why the verdict was what it was?
Oh, I do. Yes. I think that if you look at the difference between the first trial and the second trial, I think that you do see that. I think that what was kept out, right, was important on the second trial. So of course the jury didn't get to hear that, but in the first trial they did. And I think that the bias against against this incest, even it was even quote worse, if you will, because it was in the family, it was incest, that at that particular time in the way that people viewed male on male type of sexual abuse was something they really couldn't grasp. In any situation, always has been hard for men to acknowledge that there is sexual abuse between males to males. Although I thought Lyle made a very good explanation of why his father did it. I always thought that was quite interesting, that this was a form of male bonding kind of thing, and that it's done. That's not too different from what you hear in incest cases where there's a special reason given for why it's, quote, okay to do. I often wondered if it had been two daughters that had killed, had shotgunned their parents. Say Eric and Lyle were female. What do you think would have been the reaction? You think there would have been a different reaction?
I think to an extent, yeah.
Yeah.
I do too, because I think we had talked, even in that era, incest in between father and daughter, certainly from Judy Herman's work, was much more, not accepted, certainly not acceptable, but was certainly talked about, but not father-son.
Do you think that is the main reason that people had such a hard time believing them? Was the,
I do. Yeah.
The male on male?
The male on male and the father-son. This is to some extent patriotic society, you know, and men are not sympathetic. I think that you found that out in the first trial with the jury splitting. Male didn't, it went 50-50 as I understand it, or close to it.
Yeah, Eric's jury was 50-50. Yeah,
Eric's jury, that the women were far more sympathetic and understanding of trauma and understanding that and could relate to that. Don't forget, a jury, you want them to identify with whatever your position is. And so if the male position is, I would never do such a thing, this could never happen, that's going to make a difference to the woman saying, I can see where that could happen. That's why the rape issue has been so hard to get moving, because men could understand a stranger, but they couldn't understand it being rape if the parties knew each other, there was a relationship. I mean, this is a complicated case because you had male on male sexual activity, you had incest, you had the mother, and people, we already talked about the mother, they couldn't understand that. I thought it was pretty understandable once you understood more about Kitty. She wasn't the victim, if you will, in the family.
Yeah, in terms of how people didn't believe them back then, it was a lot more of a commonly held viewpoint. I know some of Eric's high school friends from California have said that they don't believe him. Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't think they can, that's what I say, they can't identify with them.
Yeah.
That I would never let that happen. I would never let my father do that. You know, I'm big and strong. And I think that's what they relate to. It's very hard. The male cases I've had, just even stranger kinds of cases, I've had cases where they would admit to robbery, but they wouldn't admit to being raped, and they had been raped, part of the robbery. And it's just very, very hard, even for the victims to come forward. Yeah, it's just not a well-understood phenomenon.
It's nice to see that changing a lot more now, though.
I think it is. I really think it is. It's too bad there's so much of it going on. I mean, that's the real...
Yeah.
The real problem is, good grief.
Sort of along those lines, do you think that if this trial was held today, that like the psychological testimony and your evaluation, that evidence would be taken more seriously or held in higher
regard? I think it would. The problem is how do you bring the male jurors around? That's the key thing. You've got the female understanding, female juror understands it, but not necessarily the male. So you'd have to be able to dispel the myths that go on in between male sexuality and see it as dominance and violence rather than sex. The other thing that they tried to make a big deal out of, which I thought was very typical of that time and typical of males, is, well, if they had sex, could he be gay? And we went round and round on that. There was never any evidence to prove or disprove, you know, any more than there was, but that was something he had to deal with, that there was a lot of things being said about him. And they never said it about Lyle, which I thought was rather interesting. Why pick on just one?
Yeah, I definitely think that would never happen in a courtroom today.
I agree. I don't think it would. And it shouldn't have happened. Well, not in the courtroom. It shouldn't even happen in
life.
Courts, yeah.
Yeah.
But the same thing happened on the Kitty Genovese case that we talked about. The police spent more time talking about her gay lifestyle than they did about who killed her. I was upset over that.
That was in like the 50s, right?
64. The whole bystander behavior was very interesting. And there's also the genesis for 911. Because when they called, they didn't have, in those days, you didn't get a direct line into some help. But I think it'd be a very different, I think today, if you had the trial today, it'd be very different.
Is there anything that comes to mind that you would change about your testimony in this case if it happened today?
I'm not sure I'd change any of the concept of my testimony. I'd certainly have developed much more from a scientific standpoint. And I think that I would do a much better job there. I think it would be more accepted on talking about the neurobiology of trauma. Is what I often do now. I mean, if you want to say, what am I doing now in court? I use that much more to help people understand the whole memory thing is another matter too. And fear, I tried to do as much as I could on the fear response, but I think we're closer in time now with a good studies about fear. People understand fear. I mean, just as a society, just look at us with the COVID. My gosh, look what we're doing to our fear that we're going to get this dreaded disease makes us do all kinds of things, doesn't it? So, but anyway, I'm just trying to think if there are any other cases that I've done. I can think of cases which come out very differently. I did a case where the 20-year-old boy, male, killed his mother, his sister, and his brother, and didn't get the death. It was a death penalty case and didn't get the death penalty. So I think we're at a very different time. You know, there's a whole family violence. This is family violence that we're talking about. 30 years has given a new perspective, I think. Don't you think?
I think so.
100%.
Yeah. And I also think that the sentence was very prejudicial. They certainly, I remember Eric saying right after it happened, he just regretted it. And he's been filled with regret over what happened. And he has to live with himself. So I don't think sitting him in jail is going to do anything more. I understand Lyle is actually running child abuse groups to get the inmates to talk about it, which I think they've tried to use their time in prison with to help. I think that's a very positive thing for them.
Yeah, I found that really interesting. I think the behavior in prison definitely
it's
demonstrated their remorse.
They've both been married too. I know Lyle's been married twice. Leave it to Lyle, right? But Eric has been Tammy. He's still married to Tammy, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I asked Leslie whether there was any chance that there could be any reviving of the case, the verdict, because you asked, what did I think of the sentence? I mean, that seems, it was the judge who made the sentence, right? Or was it a jury? Did the jury decide to no parole, life with no parole?
It was between that and death. I think they only had the two
options. Only had two choices, okay.
Because they had voted for first degree with a special circumstance.
Because of the gun? What was the special circumstance?
Lying in wait, I think.
Well, they didn't lie in wait. That's not a typical lying in wait, I don't think. Lying is wait when you're waiting for the person to come. They were
I don't think it was first degree murder either, but I guess.
Right, I certainly don't either. Right. Well, they got their, they got what they wanted. Prosecution did.
Yeah.
And the judge, I would say the judge was important in that.
Yeah, it only took them retrying the brothers to actually get it though.
And cutting out lots of their defense testimony.
Oh, yeah.
So why do you think that young people have taken such an interest in this case?
Oh, I think that in the last decade, certainly, this whole, I do credit the Me Too movement. I think that it's been very interesting to bring up old cases that women have. I haven't seen any men do it, but the women have, and they're taken seriously. And so that, I think, has helped. And the I would say that has helped. And plus, I think the other thing would be the advances that we've made in terms of understanding trauma has been good and helpful. And that many people have come forward to tell their story, I think, has been helpful. Especially male on male. I think that that's, I don't think it's come as much as it should, but that people are much more understanding of trauma, male trauma.
Yeah. I'll let you ask the last question, Maya.
We've touched a little bit on this, but do you think that it's time for the brothers to be released?
Yes, I do. I do. I don't think it serves any purpose. I don't know what the rationale was for. It's still a personal decision that's made by jury or judge. And I do think that they have served their time. I don't know how long you have to serve if it's supposed to be for punishment. I don't think they're going to, the chances of their repeating there's no chance of their repeating anything.
I don't understand what the...
I don't either. Yeah, I agree. I don't understand.
I don't think they're a danger to society.
Yeah. Yeah, if you're trying to protect society, then I don't think they're any danger. The problem is, how would they be? I mean, so much has changed. Can you imagine being in a capsule for 30 some years?
Yeah.
They wouldn't even know how to probably use an iPhone or the internet, or I don't know how much privilege they have in prison. Do you?
I know they're in I don't know if it's low security, but like they have, it's like a rehabilitative yard because of good behavior.
Yeah, they're
They've
in the
definitely
small,
so, yeah. shown that they are not a danger.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And they would put enough restrictions on them that they couldn't, so.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Well, you're very welcome. You're very well prepared. All these questions, that's great. And I think what you're doing is great. And thank happy you. To do it.
Yeah, thank you.
And then
it's
I'll
been
come
really
back and talk. I'll talk about my profiling book, okay? How you
Sounds
go to a crime
good.
Scene and profile who did it.
That is very interesting to me. I will probably be your first buyer.
Okay. Well, yeah, if you pre-order, you get a complimentary chapter. We took one of the chapters out on profiling because we had too much in there. And I think they're going to send people their Facebook. It's Hachette, Hachette. Books, Hachette books.
Okay.
Perseus. Yeah.
I'll put it in our video post so people can.
Oh, good. Very good. Okay. Well, thanks a lot. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good evening.
Okay. You bet. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Yep. Bye.
Thanks everyone for listening to our interview with Dr. Burgess. Next episode will be focused on the relationship between Kitty and Jose. We'll be delving into that. So yeah, thanks for listening, guys.